Hi, my name is Steven.
Hi, I'm April.
This is the 3Pi² ABA Business Leaders Podcast, where we discuss topics on how to create and grow an ethical and sustainable ABA practice.
Together, Steven and I owned a 7-figure ABA practice that provided both clinic and in-home services.
3Pi² has helped over 900 ABA practices start up and expand with our comprehensive products and services geared specifically to ABA. Now, let's get to the podcast.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to ABA Business Leaders by 3Pi². I'm April. And this is Steven. And today with us, we have a very special guest, Mandy Ralston. Thank you for joining us, Mandy.
Thank you guys for having me. It's good to see you.
So we're coming off the end of our How Can We Help series. And by the time you guys will be listening to this in the new year, we will have already technically finished our How Can We Help series. However, I would like to say that I feel like what Mandy has to offer our field and what she's doing within our field definitely falls under the category of how can we help, and we could probably justify that a lot of our podcasts are how can we help, since that's part of our values here at ABA Business Leaders, helping all of you guys out there, doing all the hard work. But first, Mandy, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Mandy Ralston, pronouns are she, her, sometimes y'all, since I'm down here in Kentucky. I always like to say, despite the big they energy in the room, I do use she and her still. I born and raised in Weston, West Virginia, a tiny town of 3,000 people. Got down here to Kentucky by way of a basketball and track scholarship and stayed ever since. I have been in the field since 1999. First was board certified as a BCABA in 2002, got my BCBA in 2014. I've built two different clinics here in Kentucky, and I sold the last one in 2019 to the fourth largest provider in the US at the time. And then in 2022, I started Non-Binary Solutions, where we are now making Noetic.ai, which is a clinical decision support system. So.
Awesome. Yeah. I follow you with y'all because I grew up in South Carolina. So, and I'm up here in Canada now. And throughout our conversation, you may hear my good South Carolina twang coming out, or, you know, some.
Your Canadian A.
Or my Canadian A. Yeah. So I also started back in 95. That was, we probably share a lot of similarities in our ABA stories. When the first family that I worked, first few families that I worked with, they flew a consultant in to South Carolina from California. I think it started like every 6 months. And when the family, like, they would get their churches and their community would like save money. And then, you know, they would have college students. I grew up near Clemson University. And so there was a lot of college, you know, students. Church members. I think one kid that I worked with, the very beginning, there were probably 30 people on his team. And it was just like this like revolving door of people coming in to help this little guy. And it was probably 40 plus hours. Some people volunteered their time. And then I think that family maybe been like a yearly, you know, had their consultant come in, and then we would have a couple of phone conversations. It's definitely, we've seen a lot of change since then.
that's exactly how I got into the field, right? I wrote a research paper in my senior year of college, and I found 7 families here in Lexington that were flying a consultant out from California once a quarter and sharing the cost of that consultant, right? And then cobbling together those ABA programs based off of Let Me Hear Your Voice and whatever other jewels, right? Mm-hmm. And I became one of the technicians with those same 7 families, and I started that first company in 1999 as straight out of college. It was me and 3 other women that founded the group called Behavioral Intervention for Autistic Children. Or BIFAC, and we grew that to 125 clients and 85 employees in 3 years. none of us were business majors, so we learned lots of very expensive lessons the hard way. And that really informed my next go round when I founded Verbal Behavior Consulting in 2007. So
Real. That's I was in the field for a while before we started our own agency. We moved to Virginia outside of DC, and I couldn't find a company that I really shared the values with and that just wasn't right fit for me. And there's so much driving in that space. And we were kind of out in the suburbs enough where there weren't a lot of clinics providing services. And so we were on a walk one day and Steven's like, there's gotta be kids here that we could service. And this was before mandates, before licensure, you know, it was relatively simple if you call opening a business simple. But, and so, yeah, that's when we got started. We ran that company until 2020. Yeah.
2021.
Yeah. 2021. Like it was when we officially closed the doors. Good old COVID just kind of sealed my deal of ready to move on to the next thing. And we moved to Canada and decided to kind of work on some life balance. definitely like starting a business is, it's a whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, clearly I'm a glutton for punishment because I keep doing it, right? This is, I think, my fifth entrepreneurial adventure. I did a yoga studio at one point, and COVID pretty much closed the doors for that 1 year later. It's a lot of learning the hard way, because if you're gonna build something new, that means that nobody's done it that way before, right? Yeah. And so there's pieces that you can borrow from other people's experiences and textbooks and podcasts or whatever, but ultimately there's a lot of work that you're just figuring it out on your own.
Yeah, right? Yeah. That's why Steven started 3x² back in, I don't know dates, but a few years ago. And a few could have been like seven, I don't know. That's what we started, because we learned so much through all the mistakes that we made. And he realized, he was growing our company like way too fast. And I said, I'm done, like, because I wanted to stay small. And so then he started 3x² with consulting with other ABA businesses, like to start up and all that stuff. So this isn't even what we're here to talk about, but I am curious, what would be your one piece of advice, if you could pick one piece of advice to give someone out there who is thinking about starting a business?
Oh, jeez.
It's a big one. It's a hard one.
No, that's like, it's a whole own talk show in and of itself.
We have 100 hours of podcast for that.
I know, right?
I mean, if you're a behavior analyst and you're going to start a clinic, then you need to have somebody on your team that is a business person, because that will save you a lot of headaches. Now, don't let the business person also then compromise your clinical ethics, right?
Yeah.
So it's a balance. You're going to have to find the balance, but you need to put people on your team that question your decisions, that question your roadmap, that push back, that don't always say yes to you, because you need to be constantly thinking about what are the implications for the changes that I make. There's always intended and unintended consequences to the changes that we make. So get a group of people around you that don't always agree with you.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great idea. With business, just being a clinician, right? That in itself, but then you add that whole business layer to it. There's a lot of decision making.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you hit on a phrase that I'm very fond of, which is all the mistakes that I made, you know. And so, you know, jumping ahead a little bit here, the care navigation model that we have, or module that we have on the noetic.ai software system, is literally a clinical version of everything I learned the hard way, right? So it's all the mistakes that I made turned into wisdom, right? Because what the care navigation module does is it's a very robust but structured intake process. And it is basically every question that I learned the hard way that I should have asked before day one of services, so that I put this person on a treatment pathway that was going to be meaningful for them, right? It's like, oh, if I just would have asked about whether they had a sleep study, then I would have known that they possibly had a seizure disorder. Or, oh, if I would have asked about genetic testing, we would have found out that this individual actually has Fragile X, right? So it's like all of these questions that I learned, again, the hard way, to ask families and to ask patients as they're coming into care. And so I always like to say it's like digital bumper rails for clinicians, right? Like, yeah, just so you are sure that you've actually buttoned the whole thing up before you get started.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, that's what, when we actually met at the CPABA conference, and after we met there, I just started digging in to see, okay, what is this noetic thing and what is Mandy all about here? Because I was like, really, I really enjoyed our conversation that day, and I just wanted to know more about it. And from some of my research, it seems like you have more of that like practitioner experience and versus,
academic.
I don't know, like academic. Yeah. Like, and so, it seems like you've just kind of dumped in a lot of what you've done over the past, I don't know how many years, and, into the system. The other thing that, that kind of interested me about it, especially in this like technology age where like everything feels so not safe, that it's not online, or how does that work?
Yeah. So it is online. So it's still software as a service, which is SaaS is the industry term for that. When we're talking about the AI portion, so there's a little guy in the corner of the software called No Yeti. This is him, a little Sasquatch looking fellow, right? So he is an AI chatbot, right? And so he is sort of like ChatGPT, but it's not ChatGPT. So we've built a large language model with a fence around it, right? Mm. And so it only knows what you feed into the software. So each patient has its own file folder, and you only put that patient's records into the file folder. And so when you're chatting with No Yeti, who we like to say takes the mystery out of treatment planning, he is able to just read what PDF records you've put into that patient's portal. He can't talk to you about any of the other patients in the software at that time, not in your organization, not in your client stack, whatever. And the reason it can't, and the reason that it's HIPAA compliant is because it never goes to the internet. Okay,
that's what.
So yeah, the information never goes out into the internet. All it's doing is borrowing the architecture of other large language models. So it's not the information that you find on the internet, it's just the architecture for it.
So like if you forget to fill in date of birth, is it going to make up a date of birth?
No, it would say, I'm sorry, that information is not available in the documents that you provided me, right? Or if you said, give me a recipe for coconut ginger soup, it would say, I'm sorry, I'm only able to answer questions related to the documents in this folder, right? So it wouldn't be able to give you a BS answer. Now, that being said, whatever documents you upload into No Yeti, right, they have to be quality documents, right? So it's session notes, diagnostic evaluation, IP goals, any of that stuff, you know. So it's like anything with AI, if you put garbage in, you will get garbage out, right? But if you put quality in, it can learn from quality information, right? And I can go off about this, but I'll let you guys keep talking. It's like I've got a whole soapbox about this whole issue at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, we had someone on, Michael Gow from
Alpaca.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. He was on last week, and well, he aired last week, and we've gotten a lot of questions from like our members, and you know, through our Facebook groups that we're in and things like that about AI. I mean, it's here. It's you know, and like we said during that podcast, like Stephen, like we both kind of fought it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess like it's kind of like having, you know, the internet on your phone or all your contacts in your phone. You like, I don't know anybody's number, right? I know my number when I was 6 years old. I still know that number, but I don't know my best friend's number, right? I barely know your number, right? Because it's in my phone. So like, I guess that's one of the big concerns about anything like this is the technology going to make your clinician even less independent? And then, you know, the other thing that I urge people to do is that I can almost guarantee there's a good percentage of your staff that are using ChatGPT And they're just not telling you, right? Because
that's right.
They have so many deadlines, like billables are, they only accept certain amounts. So we're pushing a lot of unbillable hours, especially on practitioners. So they have to do a lot of work and they have a little bit of time. So they're using ChatGPT and they shouldn't be using ChatGPT.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly where I was going with that. Yeah. Because it's like, it's here.
Yes.
Like, it's here. Yes. And so now, like,
yeah, I mean,
who do you work
this
with?
Is, right? Yeah. You're gonna start to hear me evangelize about this.
Go for it. That's why you're here.
Yeah. We are very interested in doing this the right way and doing it ethically and collaborating with clinicians to get feedback on what we're doing and whether it's useful, whether it's appropriate, right? Whether it's ethical. And, you know, one of the things that I'm going to make a big deal about is that, unlike several other platforms that are popping up that are using machine learning and AI for tools to help clinicians, you've got a clinical person that is the architect of the software.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
First and foremost, I'm 26 years as a practitioner, right? Yeah. I'm not a technologist. It just so happens that I learned about the technology and I learned how to make some of these things, but I have a chief technical officer that translates all of my clinical ideas into code, right? Whereas several other of these groups are coming at it from a technology background, right? Mm-hmm. And what they don't understand fundamentally, which is the problem with applied behavior analysis in our field right now, is that no two clinicians do anything the same way.
Right.
It's not standardized. So they think that they can dump a bunch of information into a data set and then rely on machine learning to make sense of that data, and it's not going to work, right? It's chaos in, chaos out, right? So the very different thing about how we're approaching bringing our data set together is that we have structured it from day one, right? So that when you bring a patient in, they are brought in the same way as every other patient. So now we have a standard deck to work from, right? So yeah. You know, I know that people are concerned about AI, and that's why I'm going to work to try to talk about what are good points, what are bad points. You know, in the data set that we're going to eventually train machine learning to look at, it will be supervised learning, right? Not unsupervised learning. Unsupervised learning is when you ask the machine to go in and make inferences and correlations to give you kind of some kind of information. Again, if you do that, it's chaos in, chaos out. So there's a website that I like to talk about called Spurious Correlations, right? Tyler Vegan, I think, is the guy's name. And he has found, you know, disparate data sets that trend exactly the same way together. So, like, the number of swimming deaths in Wisconsin are correlated with the amount of cheese that is eaten in New York City, right? Like, those are things. So that is machine learning that has taken wild data sets and then been able to make a correlation between them. It is up to human beings, aka clinicians, to determine whether the inferences that the machines are coming up with are actually, what's the word? Applicable, useful. Mm-hmm. There it is, useful is the word. And so that's the difference between machine learning on its own and supervised machine learning. And that's what I'm saying. We're trying to collaborate with different organizations and the people that are beta users to get feedback about, did that answer make sense to you? Was that a clinically good answer? So on and so forth. So yeah, like I said, I can go off on this forever.
So, because I think what is different about you guys is that's like the extra, I don't know. I don't think I didn't brief Stephen before. We like to just come on and talk and learn, but you guys have like actually treatment planning decisions. Like, this helps you. It's not just like taking the information, helping you turn it into a treatment plan or a session note or like those templates, because there's a place for that, and that can be helpful to like get you started on something, right? That you still have to make sure that you, of course, read over it. But what you guys are like really helping with the decision making itself of like, you have a 12-year-old that comes in with maybe some social skills, you know, some maybe like minor issues, maybe needs a couple of hours of sessions a week or something. And it's not gonna like start you out with like the VB map, right? Like, it's gonna take that individual case And if I understand correctly, there was like some philosophy behind it of like the actual clinician that's using it. How does that work?
Again, don't think of this as people becoming more dependent. I like the phone analogy and the phone number analogy, right? Because yeah, I don't remember most of my phone numbers anymore either. But in trade, we become more efficient at contacting people, right? And so with AI and some of these clinical treatment tools, it won't be that we are so much dependent, but we will become more efficient at the things that we need to be doing, right? Including thinking about clinical treatment decisions, right? How to be more efficient to narrow the gap of the amount of information that I need to be thinking about smaller with actual data points rather than just going off my own personal bias and experience, right? So I like to think of these tools as turning our clinicians into bionic clinicians, right? That they've got both their own brain, their own thinking, their own lived experience, and also some type of digital technology that's going to help make them more efficient and hopefully more correct, right? I don't know where I was going that.
Dang.
That always happens.
I know, that happens.
Yeah. I see your wheels spinning.
I guess, like, you know, with, and I'm sure you're aware of this, but, like, I think when we talked to Eric Dubuque, mm-hmm. he mentioned that, like, the field, the average BCBA right now has 3 years of experience. And I'm sure 3 years of experience is not much experience, right? And so, like, and again, we go back, okay, I'm going to use ChatGPT or I'm going to use Gemini or whatever bot you're using. And like with ChatGPT, my experience, like I often talk about this, but I put in a prescription that my doctor had given me, and I'm like, I just want to see what side effects there are. And so I was like, hey, Chatty, what are the side effects of this thing? And it was like, oh, there's no side effects. It's great. And so then I was like, I don't buy that. So I went into Google. And it had a huge list of side effects because every medication has side effects. And so then I said, well, hold on a second. And I just copy and pasted Google into it. And it was like, oh, yeah, you're right, right? I've had it tell me dates of things where I never gave it dates, right? It would make up names. It'll make up anything you want. Like, it'll fill gaps, right? And so, like, when you have a BCBA with 3 years experience or maybe a year experience and they're throwing PDFs and things into the chat bot, right? Saying, okay, now make a treatment plan. Like, I just, this worries me, right?
Yes.
And so you building something like this that can allow that
function
to go in the right direction with clinical support, I think it has to go this way because everybody's using it, right? So right. I'm just wondering, like, how are there, like, I know you mentioned guardrails. So, like, how do the guardrails work and how can you take the guardrails off? Let's say you have 25 years experience and you're like, okay, I can play with this a little bit more versus somebody with 2 years experience. I'm just curious how it works.
Yeah. So when I say guardrails, it's making mountains of information more narrow to what you need to think about. So based on how you answered this question, then it will either branch off into other questions or it will say, okay, you can move on to this next question. So that's the guardrails, right?
Right.
So even if you have 25 years of experience, it is guiding you through the most efficient treatment pathway, right? And so all that does is make you faster. Right, as a 25-year clinician versus somebody that has 1 or 2 or 3 years of experience is also, while using the software, learning how to think about all of the clinical decisions they need to make. So they pass the test, so they know what to think about. They don't know how to think about it. That takes experience, right? And most experience comes from mistakes. So let's let them learn with the guardrails about how to think about all the information at the same time, and they will become more efficient at themselves. So again, guardrails, if you want to call it that way, digital mentorship, if you want to call it that way, right? It's a way of saying, hey, did you think about this? Have you looked at this data? You might also consider this. And ultimately, it is still the clinician's choice, right? This is meant to offer suggestions. It's not telling them what to do, right? Oh. So yeah, I mean, the reason that nobody should be putting anything, patient data, into ChatGPT or anything like it on the internet because it is not HIPAA compliant.
Right.
There's that. B, the reason that it hallucinates or gives you wrong answers is because its entire data set is the entirety of the internet.
Right.
So why is it wrong sometimes? Because there's a lot of wrong shit on the internet, right? So again, it's like, if you put quality information into our model, it's going to give you quality information back out. But let's say you had a report that was written by a first year BCBA without much experience, that report may not be as quality. And therefore, if you're asking the Yeti about information from that report, it's going to give you that level of quality. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it could also, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, I mean, there are some BCBAs out there, and I look at it from an engineering standpoint. My background is engineering. There are some really rigid engineers. They like to do things one way. They've always done it this way. Why would I do anything different, right? And so there are some BCBAs, I would say, that have that same kind of personality trait. I do things this way. I always do it this way. Why would I do it any different? I would assume that this could maybe open up a different perspective and say, hey, have you ever, like you said, hey, have you ever thought about doing it this way, right?
That's right. Yeah, you sort of touched on this, April. It's the story that I like to tell is what typically happens is that families will come into a provider and say, my 8-year-old son still isn't toilet trained. He only eats 5 things and we can't go to the grocery store because he runs out in the parking lot. And the provider says, great, we'll do the ABLES and the Vineland as an assessment. And those two assessment tools have nothing to do with the 3 things that the family just told you were impacting quality of life in their household, right? Okay. And so what our goal development module, which is the second module in the sequence on noetic.ai, what that does is, again, it's an interview-based assessment tool that you as a clinician or the user, and you're talking with the family or the patient and getting an idea of what's impacting their quality of life. And then it helps tie that to what is it about this person's symptoms of autism that are actually impacting this quality of life area, right? And then based on how you answer all of that module, it then recommends various assessment tools that might be appropriate based on the person's age, the quality of life area that you're talking about, the funding source, right? So that, again, you can actually get a valid baseline on an assessment tool to tie this to medical necessity. I know that there's a lot of chatter in the field about getting denials for treatment plans that have things that are considered custodial, as in the parents should be teaching it, like toothbrushing or potty training or whatever it is. And this module helps draw the line between, no, it's not custodial. It's actually specifically related to this person's symptom burden as to why they can't brush their teeth or why they're not toilet trained, right? So it ties that information together. So I hope it's also going to be an educational tool for the payers in some situations, that they understand the full architecture of how some of these goals really do relate to a medically necessary treatment plan.
Yeah, that was something I definitely wanted to touch on, was medical necessity, because, I mean, of course, yes, it's important, but it's also like a buzzword that everyone's talking, you know, it's like, oh, medical necessity, well, how can I write that word? And I'm like, well, okay, first of all, we're not writing a goal just for insurance. You know, this goal is for this individual. I mean, yes, of course, that's very important. I mean, we have to take that into consideration to get paid for it.
Yeah.
But we have to remember that we're providing services for an individual, and we want it to be what this person needs, right? Versus we just are writing it this way for insurance. Now, yes, do we have to tweak it? Do we have to, like, play around? Yeah, we do. But that's a whole skill within itself, right? And so that's what I was curious how this would assist in that skill. And it sounds like it does.
Yeah, I mean, so the software that we've built, again, the decision model portions of it are not AI based, right? The only thing that's AI based is the little chatbot. That's okay. So the decision models themselves are based off of my clinical experience, right? And I built out a bunch of algorithms to take people through problem solving given certain scenarios. So think of it as a Rubik's Cube, right? The first time somebody ever gets a Rubik's Cube, on average, it takes them 4 hours to solve it, right? when you get really good at it and you're, you know, maybe you're a speed cuber, you can get down under 5 seconds. And that's what these kind of technologies do for you, right?
Is
quickly take you through algorithms to get to problem solving faster. And so one of the algorithms that I built into the software is this medical necessity criteria, right? And so I've made it very simple. I call it the medical necessity or MNC sandwich. So you get two pieces of bread. Top part of the bread means that it has to be tied to an assessment, right? So it actually has to have an assessment with a baseline score. And then the bottom part of the bread is that it has to be socially significant. So it has to have a quality of life outcome that is socially significant to the family or to the patient itself, right? And in between the two pieces of bread, you have to have at least one, if not all three, or some combination of two, of the following three fixins, if you will. It either needs to prevent further regression, it has to ensure health, safety, or functioning, or it allows for further integration. So it could be all three, it could be a combination of two, but it has to be at least one. And if you do those three things, then you have achieved medical necessity, right? And so that's a very, very simple example of how I can take, because of my experience, a very complicated process and make something for somebody that says, here, this is the recipe for how to get where you need to go. But that takes years of being able to do that fluently, right? So that's why this software is useful, is that, again, it's not doing it for you, it's teaching you how to think about it, right?
Yeah. Well, that was going to be kind of my next, where I wanted to go next in this, is prior to Noetic and prior to you, like, you know, developing this, I'm sure you like lived in your brain for a while as you were like trying to figure out how to like get this out there. Right. But prior to that, with decision-making, is that something that like, how am I trying to ask? It's like, was this something that you were like, you came into the field and you're like, man, I'm good at this. I'm really analytical. I'm great at decision-making. Or is this something that like it took a lot of time and a lot of years to get to this point?
Totally.
I don't know. You know where I'm going with that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I copied as much as I could of my mentor when I was very young, right? Yeah. I literally went up to Dr. Carbone's clinic in New York and stole as much information and processes as I possibly could, and then took them back to Kentucky and tried to replicate them, right? And I may not have understood why he did the things the way that he did them, but I saw that they were effective, so I tried to implement them over here. And that's a natural learning process for a lot of people, right? But it takes years to then be able to go back and say, ah, I see the analysis of why we did the things that we did, right? Rather than just saying, this kid looks similar to this kid, so I'm going to repeat some of the things that I did with that guy with this guy, mm-hmm. right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think it helps as well that I have ADHD, I'm neurospicy, neurodivergent, my brain is nonlinear in its thinking. I like to say that I'm like a human octopus, I've got my tentacles going all over the place, and so my intellectual decorator crab is constantly going, oh, that could be useful sometime, and hey, this looks like that's kind of fits with this part.
Yeah.
And because of all the experience that I've had, I'm able to, you know, have my own little neural network of understanding how things are interconnected. That takes years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about like kids that you were talking about, like, oh, well, these guys are similar. Let's do this. And I do. I remember back in the day, that's what I did. I started forming patterns, and I'm like, okay, well, but that's not working with this kid in the same way that it, you know, what made that happen? Oh, this this piece, and then it's just, I don't know. You're just like kind of all piecing it together, and it
that's
comes with a lot of practice. But yeah, having also a very neurospicy ADHD brain, like. I don't like to say superpower, but that skill that you have there does like help to like think outside of that. At the same time, though, it's very typical for my personal thinking for me to be very black and white as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it, which, you know, it's like, oh, it, like trying to make sense of it. Why, like in this case, I'm like, so black and white, it's got to be this or it's got to be this. There's no in between. And then in this answer, I can't give you a direct answer because there is no direct answer, but I can give you the whole story of how everything pieces together, and then you can take with it what you want, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I mean, again, part of the point of this care navigation module, this intake process that brings each of the patients into the software in a standardized, structured fashion, is that we are trying to get to the bottom of just that sort of dilemma. Like, mm-hmm. people with autism are so different, right? But there are characteristics, traits, histories that may be similar. And so if we get a big enough data set of patients that are standardized and structured that we can start to compare them, like, you guys look similar and you guys look similar, and then we can track what treatment decisions are employed and their mm-hmm. outcomes, then with a full digital ecosystem, we can go back and look at the profiles and who responded best to what types of interventions and what types of settings at what intensity and so on and so forth, right? So that we can get these behavioral phenotypes of individuals with autism to know that this phenotype does really well with 20 hours a week, and this phenotype tends to only need 10 hours a week, and this phenotype does really well at a telehealth model, but this phenotype needs an early intensive 40 hours a week, right? Rather than trying to throw a blanket intensity and trying to report blanketly on autism as outcomes is insane, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Like trying to report on just outcomes for autism, I always say, is like asking oncologists to just report on cancer. Like, never mind which kind of cancer, never mind how it's affecting you or how severe it is, never mind your social determinants of health and whether you've been able to access care in the first place, like all of that. That's bananas. And that's what we're trying to do with autism right now. So we need to get better at identifying the subtleties of these individuals and see them holistically to treat them properly and not in a black and white way. It has to be non-binary.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to my next question. So will you tell us a little bit about non-binary solutions?
Sure. So I like telling this story. I have to do a lot of raising money for a startup, for a technology thing. I have to go out and pitch a lot. And I get a lot of unsolicited feedback about the name of the company. that you should change the name of your company. That sounds weird. It sounds like it got something to do with sex, noise. And so I always like to educate people about this. It's like I named the company on purpose, Non-Binary Solutions, because there's three main issues. One, people are not binary. They're not black and white. They are shades of gray, right? And therefore, in order to treat people properly, you need to see the full amplitude of their humanity, right? You can't just peg them one way or the other. They're more than just their race. They're more than just their diagnosis. They're more than just their gender or their sex, right? They're a combination of all those intersectionalities. Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs were the founders of Apple, and they got into an argument purportedly at one point. And Wozniak said to Jobs, you know, it's not binary. You can be both decent and brilliant at the same time, because apparently Jobs is a bit of an asshole employee. But most importantly, I get to tell people on stage all the time now that did you know that it is 6 times more likely that individuals on the spectrum will not identify with the gender they were assigned at birth? Right. So now if you care about individuals on the spectrum, you also have to care about individuals that are non-binary or trans, right? Because there's been overlap there now. And so it's a way of creating empathy and educating people, right?
There's one question, so going back to, there's a couple of questions in here, but going back to that, not the right experience, but also there are some things that we just don't need to change in any person, right? Like, so I think a big one would probably be like, you know, self-soothing things that they do, right?
Like STEM.
Mm-hmm. And so does your system, if somebody wanted to work on those things,
if a parent was complaining about, correct. Oh, my child just keeps humming, and this humming is driving me crazy, but the humming is hurting no one, right. and their child has a right to hum
yes.
in their home or something like that. Yes, right. And then the parent was like wanting to decrease the humming, and then we would want to be able to ask more about like why, and maybe right. offer the parents some techniques or correct. Something. Like, is that kind of yes, what you're thinking yes. about? Like kind of like boutique style of therapy?
Yes. Yeah. So does your system help with that? Maybe suggesting something else
like
or
social validity yes, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that'll be something on the product roadmap, right? Some of those more detailed, nuanced things mm-hmm. like that, yeah. Self-soothing behaviors. Again, it's not binary, right? It's right. not, yes, you should be allowed to do it, or no, you shouldn't. Right. It's very nuanced. And so getting to what is the reinforcer for the child in this process, right? Is it actually automatic reinforcement, right? Or is there some kind of social relationship between the child and the parent that when the humming happens, there's a tension? You know, there's a whole functional analysis that has to happen for that. So it can't be a black and white, we never work on humming or we always work on humming, right? It's got to be more nuanced than that. That will be on the product roadmap. But right now, I mean, the initial two modules that we have that are currently released are really designed to help clinicians get in the ballpark of what would be a meaningful outcome for a family. All right. And so it takes you through the goal development module, takes you through, I think, 36 different quality of life areas. And there are 7 of them that are weighted at the top, right? So if you said that those 7 areas were something that was affecting your quality of life at home in the last 1 month, then they would float to the top of the priority in the treatment plan. Right? So it's safety, communication, eating, sleeping, toileting, access to care, and emergency preparedness. If any of those 7 items are something that are affecting the family's quality of life, they should be priority, right? So yeah. that we are preventing the thing that I told you about that happens frequently. He's not toilet trained. He only eats 5 things. We can't go to the grocery store anymore. And you don't listen to that, and you go say, I'm going to do the ABLES, and then now I'm going to pick G5 off of the ABLES because that squares blank, right? So this is helping them see that this is where they need to have their head in terms of, you know, getting a patient-reported outcome that's meaningful.
Yeah, I love those categories. Yeah, for sure.
And then from there, the next 30 or so are social functioning, community functioning, physical functioning, psychological functioning. And then there's drop downs to each of those different sections, right? So social relationships. Do you have a relationship with your siblings or friends? Do you have hobbies or games that you can do? Are you able to access transportation appropriately, right? All of those are important, but they're not as important as those big 7, right? And so you can work on the other ones, but just know you're going to prioritize anything off of that first 7 list mm-hmm. first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are always good pieces for parent education as well, right? Mm-hmm. And helping to focus and refocus and remind the parent, like, oh, yeah, I get this thing. Yes, and we'll get to that. Right now, we're working on these, you know, and once we get some headway here, then we'll have some time and some space to work on some of these other.
Yeah, I like it sounds like, and maybe this is like, I think what you said is like, when you get a large enough data set, but it'll also, it kind of shows you the pathway that works best for based on, you know, all of the things that you've outlined. And then you could actually assign meaningful key performance indicators at this mm-hmm. point where you're not yeah. flying blind, like, oh, I guess, right? Like, right. And you could actually have meaningful targets that would, you know, okay, you could even share this with the parents, I assume, like, this is yep. kind of the path, right? This is what you should expect, this kind of a window based right. on the data that we have. So there's almost, it's almost like maybe a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Well, like every child is fine that the way they are, but like, you know what I mean? It's probably going to give some sense of relief maybe for some of these parents to see that there is a pathway, right? That it's, they're not alone, right? That this...
Right.
That this works and this is how it works, right? Like,
yeah, just being able to say, you know, typically in cases similar to yours, this is what we tend to expect based on the data, right?
Right.
That may not necessarily be true for you, but it gives us a pathway
right.
for expectations. And based on how your data trends, we should be able to adjust our interventions so that you continue on that pathway, right? So yeah, I think it will be eventually meaningful. I mean, talk about big data sets. Here's where this is all going eventually. I met a founder in New York that had developed an algorithm that was able to identify individuals that would receive a Parkinson's diagnosis 6 years ahead of time based on patient claims data alone, right? That's the power of big data, right. Is being able to say, I see a pattern in all of these other visits coming up to that lets me know typically when I see a fall and another fall and then 6 months later another fall and they're getting shorter together, this is a person that's going to be diagnosed with Parkinson's in the future. Right. And I mean, extrapolate that to what we can do for individuals with autism that may also develop a seizure disorder, that may also have other types of gastrointestinal issues, you know, all those things. I think the future of technology for people on the neurodivergent spectrum is going to be amazing. Yeah. I hope.
Yeah, yeah, right?
Yeah, I think it also, like you said, it guides practitioners through the process so they're learning at a quicker rate, but it also, they get to drop some of these things that, I mean, it is what it is. They do it because they have to, and there's no other reason, right? Okay, I have to write it this way because, but it does nothing for the child, it does nothing for the family. Well, it does because it allows them to get access to services, but really,
I think this is going to make a more transparent process for the payers as well, yeah. Right? To understand what they're approving, why they're approving it, right? Because it's supposed to be in the best interest of all three parties, that sure. The payer, the patient, and the provider, that you get the best possible outcomes for the shortest amount of time in treatment at the best possible rate. That's right. What value-based reimbursement is all about. And we can't get there until we standardize all the parts and pieces of what we do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everyone in the field is talking about quality, as we should.
Yeah.
But personally, one of my big themes, I guess, for like 2025 that I really want to focus on is quality. And I've asked quite a few BCBAs recently, what is quality to you? And they can't answer it. And it's not any judgment on that person. I see that as like a field issue. Like, how do we measure quality? How do we know if we are providing quality services? How do we know if we, you know, even if we have our KPI in place and values-based leadership and all of these things, that it's the number that it's leading us in the right direction, right. And we're not just, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, like, that was one of the big things around KPI is if you're incentivizing something and you don't know if that's the right thing to incentivize, this can end tragically, right?
Right, you can, like, not take certain cases because you have to stay on the certain
correct.
Track.
Yeah, right? you start focusing on the number itself and not the intention behind the number, and so, yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about operational KPIs, then yeah, that's problematic. It can't just be that, right?
Right.
It has to be both and, right? It has to be the clinical quality and the operational efficiency at the same time. Hopefully mostly clinical quality, right? I mean, I get this is a business and you have to have your KPIs, but it's also people's lives. And so what is quality? I mean, I talk about quality of life in terms of the patient, the individual, as maximum independence and happiness at their level, whatever that looks like, right? How can I get you the most access to reinforcement in your environment, right? And the minimal amount of punishment, right? That's what quality of life means for all individuals, I hope. And so how do we measure that? Well, a lot of it's probably going to depend on patient-reported outcomes. How do you feel about the services that you've gotten, right? Mm-hmm. In some cases, the individual will be able to advocate for themselves and be able to report on that. In other cases, it's going to be the families, right? Did our services provide something meaningful for you? Did you understand your services, right? Did people listen to you, right? Again, you know, sometimes families will come to you and ask you to work on things that may not be medically necessary, right? And so you have to be able to educate them on why you can't work on that particular issue or whatever it is, or why you need to emphasize other issues that may be more medically necessary. Quality.
No, I love that. I love that definition.
I'm just curious, and this may not be something in your system yet, but like, how do you feel about self-advocation for everyone, but especially the people that we work with, right? Like, how does that measure on your list of priorities, I guess, and how do you implement that into the system, or what is your opinion on that?
Yeah, again, to the degree that the patients themselves can answer the questions in the interview process, we want that to occur, right? We want their input. We want them to be able to advocate for themselves. I am very happy to see the Profound Autism Alliance has been formed, because there are so many individuals on the spectrum that cannot advocate for themselves, right? And I know that there's been a lot of online chatter with certain groups of individuals or certain individuals that are very fierce self-advocates, and they have a lot to say in some cases about applied behavior analysis. And that criticism is not unfounded, right? There's a lot of applied behavior analysis that has not been awesome, right? There's behavior analysts that have not been awesome. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we get canceled the whole field, right? And so I like to educate folks and say, look, just because you share a diagnosis with a group of people does not mean that you get to talk for the whole group, right? So if you're advocating for yourself, you're advocating for yourself, right? Your lived experience, your data is valid, absolutely. But you've got to let everybody else have that same opinion or opportunity to express their opinion.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I guess it's, you know, I've said this often, I don't know where I stole this from, but I think most of the anti-ABA folks, and again, like, I agree with you, a lot of this is completely valid.
Absolutely.
It's, their concern is with bad ABA, right?
That's right.
If you get good ABA, I think that it can be very beneficial, but there is a lot, probably goes back to that 3 years experience in the field. It probably goes to that low reimbursement rate, lots of unbillable time, right? Where you're having to spend your focus. And it sounds like that's kind of where you're hoping to alleviate a lot of the issues, is giving the practitioner back their time so they can actually focus on what matters.
Absolutely. I mean, I fell in love with this science and this field 26, 27 years ago because I saw the power of the technology to change people's lives. And I still believe that, right? So I want to do everything I can to help ensure quality and happiness for practitioners and patients.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for being with us today. I'm really
excited.
And
what you're doing in the field.
Yes. Thank you so much. Because I'm really excited. You know, when we closed our company and I decided to help Stephen with 3x² and ABA business leaders as we like transitioned our family, and I was trying to decide like when to go on my next step, right? And I was pretty certain I didn't want to stay in ABA. I was pretty sure I was ready to leave. And I was just kind of in that moment of exploration and seeing what else is out there and seeing what else I wanted to do, and pretty sure I didn't want to stay. And I started helping Stephen more. I joined him on the podcast and, you know, networking with people and training and things like that. And my mind's changed. I'm really inspired by a lot of people in our field that are doing really amazing things, like yourself. Especially in the last year, we've met so many talented and passionate people in the field, and I'm here for a little longer at least. it's really great to see, and I like the direction that, you know, we work with over 1,000 ABA companies in, you know, in the nation, and so we get to kind of take a little bit of a temperature of what's going on. And you know, for the most part, it feels there's some hope there. It feels like things are improving and growing, right, as the field grows. And
Yeah, I mean, I do this as part of my presentation, my hashtag It's Not Binary talk that I've been doing all over the country this year. I take people through a timeline of like 1970 through 2022 and the rate of rise in autism. And I point out a very specific inflection point in the data where we go from one in every 500 individuals to one in every 150 individuals in a 5-year span. And what happened between 1995 and 2000 is that in 1995, 3% of Americans had logged onto something called the World Wide Web. Right? Just 3%. And by the time you get to 2000, 80% of Americans have downloaded music. Right? So in the span of 5 years, look at the adoption rate of the technology of the internet, right? Well, guess what? We're here again because AI is here.
Yeah.
And it's going to do the same thing to our culture and our understanding of the world. So things are not going to look remotely the same in 5 years from now.
No,
it's not. And that's what Stephen, not that long ago, he said, okay, I got to jump on this bandwagon, right? Yeah. Like, I jump on this. It's like, if there for a minute, we had a conversation. We're like, okay, we're the crotchety old people. We're like, get off my lawn. Like, you know, like scared at Google, right? Yeah, like, you know, back, you know, like, but it's, you know, when you step back and you look at it in a different light, like, wow, like what opportunity we have. And, you know, it, like I say about our child's talents and skills, if we can help shape them for the positive, then all will be great, right? Like, you know, like let's take this and use it in a way that will help promote quality and you know, for people's lives. So.
Yeah.
I know this will probably come out a little bit later, but we are actively looking for beta access users to come on board, and we give 90 days free access to the software. Mm-hmm. And based on the amount of time or the number of patients that they put through the software to help us get feedback, they get discounts on the subscription service moving forward.
Oh, nice.
So if you want to tell folks that you can go to noetic.ai and sign up, that is going to be live this afternoon. So.
Oh, perfect. So this will air in January. So as long as is all of that still current, we can get the links from you and put it in the show notes and...
Yeah.
Great. Well, Mandy, thank you so much for your time today. We truly appreciate it. And thank you for all that you're doing in the field.
Thank you guys for getting the word out there. I appreciate your work as well.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Hopefully it was helpful. If you would like to gain access to this entire video and actually our entire library of videos, please join our ABA Business Leaders membership. You can find that at www.3pisquare.com.